If Oprah was like, Harry, you need to turn your life around, I'd be like, Oprah, whatever you say.
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avrigan, and just allow me to declare that among the many things that 2016 did to us, it basically killed the idea of the news cycle slowing down over the weekend. So many huge stories broke on weekends, it felt like, this year. So it's only fitting that we end 2016 with what was another weekend-long freakout, this time about the news that was reported on Friday night regarding the nature of Russia's interference in the 2016 election. So
got that alert at a bar. Really, put a damper on things.
I got it at home, about to get ready for my like usual Friday night 10 p.m. go to sleep, and then I ended up just like staying up and reading about Russia until 2 a.m. Yeah. So let's talk about all that. Let's relive our exciting Friday nights with our usual panel. Nate Silver, editor-in-chief. Hello, Nate.
Hello, team.
You're like a modern-day Newt Rockne over there, just rallying the troops. Claire Malone, who has yet to learn to turn off push alerts when she heads out for the evening.
That's true.
Hello, Claire.
Hello.
And WizKid Harry Enten. Hello, Harry.
I'm glad to be here with all of you, and I must remark that I don't really think of Nathaniel as a modern-day Newt Rockne as much as a modern-day Rich Kotite, but there we are.
Wow. As an Eagles fan, I really get that, and it sort of depresses me. Okay, let's get into it. And in addition to the Russia story, we're also going to talk about Donald Trump's pledge to drain the D.C. swamp. And we'll try and define exactly what the swamp is and what Trump's moves so far have said about how he is hoping to change D.C. And we're going to do that with our friend Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. But let's start with this Russia story. And forgive me here, but I'm going to try and offer a bit of a recap. This may take a minute, but let's see if I can bring us up to speed. So we've known that WikiLeaks was a major player in this election, particularly by releasing hacked emails from the DNC and John Podesta, and many of those hacks were reportedly tied to Russia. But then on Friday night, as we just discussed, the Washington Post and then quickly some other news organizations jumped on board, reported that sources in the CIA had confirmed that Russia was not only trying to disrupt the U.S. election, but specifically trying to influence it in favor of Donald Trump. And one element of that conclusion may be that there's evidence that they also hacked the RNC, but that never made its way to WikiLeaks. Moreover, the Washington Post and now others report that this finding was presented to the Obama administration and a bipartisan set of congressional leaders, including Mitch McConnell, before the election. But we know that none of those leaders spoke up about that particular element of the report, either because they didn't believe the finding or they didn't want to go public with it. So now we get to today. Obama is now calling for a full review. And there's some breaking news just as we were coming into the studio about how some electors in the Electoral College are asking for a briefing before they vote, which really ties this story to the fallout of the election. So suffice it to say, the CIA's assessment has reopened a conversation about Russia's role, the nature of Trump's victory, et cetera, et cetera. Trump, by the way, continues to say that he doesn't know how or even if Russia was involved, but he's remaining, I'd say, somewhat vague on that front. And then I just want to add that it's worth noting that there's all sorts of anonymous sources, competing levels of certainty in the intelligence community. So if like you're a fan of clear-cut, on-the-record storylines, this is not the story for you.
Stop reading anything.
Yeah. But I guess that's the point of espionage. It's supposed to be a little confusing. So let's talk about it. But I also want to make sure we're not just looking backwards at the effect that this may have had on the election, but also forward to our relationship with Russia, which is a big, big question. So, Nate, looking backwards for right now, what's actually new here, right? We knew since early October that Russia was interfering in the election. Why is it so different that the CIA is now contending that Russia was specifically trying to help Trump win? We knew Russia was a big player all along, right?
We did, but it was not a story that necessarily got as many headlines as it could have, and the specificity wasn't as high as it could have been either. You know, someone did a comparison about the amount of headlines on the Comey letter, which was a nothing burger of a story. The letter
I was about to suggest nothing burger.
Yeah.
It's a technical term.
As compared to Russian hacking. And there was some coverage of it, but not that much.
And you think that if the news had gone this extra step of saying, oh, they're trying to not just interfere with the election, but tilt it towards Trump specifically, that would have somehow made it stickier?
I don't know. I mean, I think you certainly had a lot of foreign correspondents at a lot of newspapers who could have done some investigation into it on their own and did things that were a bit more pointed. I mean, I don't think it's obvious necessarily that it would have been wise for Obama or someone to come out and say, hey, Russia's hacking the election. I mean, he kind of did a little
bit,
right?
They gave pretty strong hints, during the election. I think,
and during the debate, Hillary Clinton.
I think there was so much noise in the election with essentially Trump stuff, right? Like just Trump saying stuff. I think this has been a thread for the last few months of the election that maybe people saw as a bit stranger than fiction, right? That the Russians would be influencing a U.S. election. I think we think of ourselves as we're not in the Cold War anymore, right? Like this is a thing that's not really happening. Maybe it's just people being a bit histrionic about things.
Do you think there was at all an element of maybe for Obama specifically, who we now know decided for whatever reason to not speak up despite getting the CIA briefing, and then just among maybe Democrats in general, to not really go at this Russia story because maybe they felt like, oh, this election's in the bag and we don't want to stir up some stuff that feels a little Cold War-y.
They weren't reading 538.
They weren't reading 538, but I'm just saying I've heard this theory floated, and I think there was an element of in the Clinton camp of like we can run on fumes and get through this thing.
Yeah, maybe. I think what's interesting is the politicization of Russia hacking U.S. parties. So I think maybe people had an eye towards post-election looking into it. I mean, and now you're seeing, what was it, Rubio today and McConnell?
So we have – I've been trying to keep track here, and as of – and their names coming in as we speak, but I have a list of 13 Republican senators who have called for an investigation since the election. McCain, Graham, Rubio, Johnson, Portman, Roberts, Moran, Lankford, Corker, McConnell, who was a little half-assed about it, Collins, Paul, Gardner, and then three others – before the election. Mm-hmm. But so, you know, I mean, this is becoming a groundswell of support. There are very few who were against an investigation. John Cornyn kind of was a little bit, and Jim Risch of Idaho said, I'm not sure this really mattered all that much. And John Bolton, you know, was certainly taking some rather hackish talking points in his quest to be Trump's something or another. But, you know, it seems like this is going to go forward, and the question is how deep and sincere is it? And the other question is, how does this affect – because we're getting some data now both from this and from a letter that a group of about 25 senators sent about Ukraine, kind of reminding Trump to police Russian aggression into Ukraine. So it gives us a list now of kind of who the Russia hawks are, and that could create problems for the Tillerson nomination because, by the way, a lot of these guys are on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
It's Rex Tillerson who's the –
Rex Tillerson. CEO. It's a hawkish group.
Exxon friend of Putin's.
Yeah.
So Trump is a little bit out over his skis on this Russia stuff, if these senators are actually willing
winter
to
metaphor.
Hold.
Yeah.
just to jump back a little bit to look at the effect on the election and the nature of the story, and then I do like talking about it going forward. But Harry, I think we should parse one thing for listeners, which is important, because I feel like this conversation about Russia interfering with our election is for some people bleeding into this question of like hacking the election. And then there were all these swirling allegations, which we've talked about here, about like voting machine hacking, all that stuff. Like it's important to tell people to guard against, like, this is specifically about how the WikiLeaks information made its way into the public, right? That's the hack, so to speak.
Right. There's no proof that anyone has gone into voting machines in Wisconsin or in Detroit and finagled with numbers. It's really interference with the election through the means of which you have suggested. And, you know,
we don't know for sure. You know, the CIA reporting through leaks about Russian espionage. I mean, it's not clear if beyond the DNC leaks there are accusations, but it's not limited to that necessarily either. I
mean,
we don't have any.
There hasn't been any discussion, at least that we have heard about, that, you know, they've gone in and done those things beyond what has already been reported. That obviously doesn't mean that's the case, although one would hope that if it was beyond that and there was some real, you know, stuff, you know, deep down in the weeds, that there would have been perhaps more of a push to get that out before the election.
Harry, is there data that helps us connect the dots between the WikiLeaks stuff and the result of the election? Do we know that people were voting against Clinton because of the email stuff?
Well, I mean, we definitely know that the email stuff with Comey certainly had an effect, or we believe it did based upon what we saw as the trend in the poll lines. In terms of the WikiLeaks, that's a far tougher thing to try and engage with and understand what exactly happened, if only because it happened over a longer period of time and was more of a leak, leak, drip, drip that was going on. So it's kind of difficult to distill whether it was that or something else that occurred during the particular time period of which those emails were released.
Nate, you tweeted a little bit over the weekend, and then you wrote about the effect that WikiLeaks and all of this may have had on the election. What's on your mind when it comes to that?
It's pretty obvious as these things go, and nothing's ever totally obvious in terms of cause and effect. But it's pretty obvious that the Comey letter was significant enough to cost Clinton the election. Now, when you lose by such a narrow margin in three or four states, a lot of things can cost you the election. But that's a fairly clear...
Wait a minute. When you say cost her the election, I mean...
If Comey hadn't issued that letter, then Clinton would probably be president-elect.
Sure, but if Clinton had also had a better response to that letter, she would have maybe been president-elect
too, right?
But
the point is that, sure, right? But the point is that this letter had no real grounds to be issued. It was kind of an exogenous factor, right? And you can kind of pull that out and say, you know, if you say, well, what if Clinton's message had been different? What if she had pitched her message more to the so-called white working class, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of contingencies there. Maybe it proves ineffective. Maybe that hurts her in Colorado or something, right? But the Comey letter could easily not have happened, and you don't have to change too many things in the multiverse where that letter doesn't happen to see that. I mean, you know, look, right. She went from a 6-point lead to a 3-point lead in a week. That's a really sharp shift that you only see usually when there's some cause behind it. I mean, I do think the polls might have tightened somewhat on its own, but I mean, if you want to talk about gaslighting, frankly, the skepticism in the media over this Comey letter now affecting the campaign, when people were so hyperbolic in their headlines about it. And by the way, the Trump campaign, Trump was saying in stump speeches, like, hey, this gives me a chance. This is going to, like, maybe win me the election. And stump speeches the day afterward, and his campaign was very excited about it. And you see, both with the Russia story and with the Comey letter, that people in the mainstream press are reluctant to take on these issues because it potentially implicates their news judgment about what they consider to be stories and what they didn't consider to be stories. And so they're very afraid of those conclusions, even though, again, in real time, I mean, the New York Times described the Comey letter as like the biggest revelation in the history of the universe. And then the same article said, oh, but it'll just affect the incoming Clinton's administration because she's so far ahead she can't lose. I mean, it was totally nuts.
And Claire, there is a CIA versus FBI dynamic at play here. The agencies have kind of different ways of approaching this, which is why
– Culture clash?
Culture clash, so to speak. So why is that important to understand when people are reading these articles?
What people always say is the FBI is filled with, like, you know, former varsity team athletes, like clean-cut guys who've never smoked a bowl in their life, right? And then another – the
I don't even know what that means.
The CIA story that people have told me – which is possibly apocryphal. They were trying to snowplow in the CIA parking lot, and they were trying. There was like a bay of cars, and they weren't moved for all of winter, and it was really getting in the way of things. And so they put up these notices, blah blah blah. No one would move the car, and so, you know, winter comes and goes, and the cars are still here. And it turns out that there had been a car stealing ring within the CIA, and they had been like stealing them for fun and like parking them in Langley's lot. Now, it's probably not true, but what it gets to is they're rule breakers. They're people who kind of do things like on the sly. It's perhaps a more, you know, if Comey, you know, went through perhaps what we hear through the grapevine of sort of hand wringing over, is it the right thing to do to put this letter out during the election? It's a different culture. There's
and the CIA in this case is like maybe more willing to connect the dots and make some inferences about Russia's involvement, whereas the FBI is maybe more like we need evidence that it could potentially end up, you know, in a court of law or something like that.
Well, I think the CIA deals with things that are – I mean, they're dealing more with overseas operations. They're probably trying to see a couple steps ahead as to what's going to be happening in the future with Russia and the U.S.'s relationships in Eastern Europe. I will also say, if we haven't said this before, that Trump has also taken sort of an oppositional stance to the CIA. I think in a statement they said, you know, these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. In other words, trying to discredit.
Well, it also claimed he had one of the largest electoral landslides in history. I mean,
there were like three lines in that, and two of them had, you know, straight up factual errors.
I mean, the term gaslighting, I guess, it's like just to, you probably heard of, to bullshit so badly that you try and make people forget their own memories, right? And doubt what actually happened. And it takes a lot of energy to fight bullshit. But, I mean, I think this was a discouraging weekend if you had the delusion that Trump was going to behave differently as president-elect than he did during the campaign. Now, he's not become president yet, so I guess there is that bridge to cross.
Harry?
I would just point out, if you're interested in reading more about the differences between the FBI and CIA culture, there was a great piece out in the Wall Street Journal over the past few weeks called The Last Diplomat, which was an investigation into someone associated with the CIA, and that investigation was done by the FBI, and how just the culture and understanding of how these two agencies work very, very differently.
It's an excellent piece.
It's an excellent piece, and I can say that as someone who doesn't tend to read long form because I get bored very quickly, I was able to get through this piece. It's definitely worth your time and understanding of what is actually going on between those two agencies.
I think we should also talk about Trump's response to this news and what it says about his relationships with government agencies going forward as a president, because I think that's just as important at this point. He said to Time magazine, I think, you know, recently, that he didn't believe that the Russians interfered. Now, this is before Friday night when this stuff became public, but presumably he's had some sort of security briefing stuff over the past couple of weeks, although there are some reports that he doesn't go to all of them. I will say that Trump's statements that basically are calling U.S. intelligence false is pretty unprecedented. I think that's something that people, maybe someone would voice in private during an intelligence briefing. But the fact that it's been voiced through press statements and tweets is probably not heartening for the career employees who work at those agencies. And I think there you're seeing a lot of people in Washington who are career, you know, government workers, perhaps being a little bit nervous about what that sort of adversarial stance to the intelligence or data that they gather, like what that means coming from Trump. So I think we should put that as a side note of what it means for, you know, obviously he's going to install his own political appointees in a place like the CIA, but it is also still filled with people who are career.
Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit about Trump's relationship with the DC bureaucracy in a second. But to wrap up this conversation, and Harry, we can give some context. So Nate mentioned the senators and congressmen who are lining up on both sides of the aisle now to call for an investigation. I mentioned the electors and so forth. But in terms of the public and how this works as a public story, and Russia as a – is there polling that shows, like, are Americans suspicious of Russia in this moment? Does Trump and Russia's, like, alignment or questions about that, is that politically territory?
I mean, what we know is that throughout the campaign, there was polls that were done by Reuters, Ipsos, and CNNORC, which suggested that more Americans than not thought that the Russian government was attempting to influence the outcome of the election. It wasn't, you know, 100%, but it was regularly 50, 60%. And a lot of Republicans thought that, as a lot of Democrats thought that. So this is not coming out of left field. And this is coming at a time at which the viewpoints of Americans towards Russia are at they're lower over the last 15 to 20 years. While perhaps if you look at the Gallup data, for instance, views towards Russia, ask Americans, do they have a favorable or unfavorable view towards Russia? And in fact, what you see is that both Republicans and Democrats are more likely to have an unfavorable view than favorable view. And it's towards the lower point, perhaps not as low as it was a year ago, but it was certainly the case. If you look at the 2016 polling, only 30% of Republicans had a favorable view of Russia per Gallup, and only 29% of Democrats. So it's bipartisan across the board. It's going to be interesting, of course, as Trump goes and if he tries to defend Russia, whether we'll start to see a larger split. But I think it shouldn't be too surprising when you put together Nate's list of people who want to do an investigation that there are a lot of Republicans who are willing to do so.
There's a lot of cultural antagonism against Russia in America. That's, you know, even though we've had, you know, if you're a younger person, if you're a millennial, you might have the last 10 or 15 years have been more Russian plutocrats buying New York apartment buildings. But, you know, up until what, like 95, all the James Bond villains were Russian. You know, there is, which is silly, but not silly, right? Because it is, I went to Moscow a couple of years ago, and it is like being in the capital city of an empire that is, there are no signs in English. Russians are very proudly not Western in many ways, right? They stand as that big, politically successful, until they weren't successful, country on the other side of the world opposing America in polls. And I think that Americans have perhaps a deep-seated cultural suspicion of Russians, and vice versa. And so it's sort of an interesting thing to watch you know, happen again after sort of the fuzzy wuzzies of the 90s.
And it's also scrambling some weird political lines here too, because you have Democrats raising the alarm about Russia, and there was Democrats who were like, you know, the Obama administration took the big reset button to Russia, and in 2012 Obama kind of criticized Romney for saying Russia was the biggest geopolitical threat. There's just some interesting. You don't buy that, Nate?
No, I do. I think Romney probably has a sly smile on his face, being like, "I was right about some stuff." Yes. In this election. You should pay more attention.
We do have to wrap up, Nate. Can you just give me, you know, a little closing thought? And I guess if you can talk about whether you feel like this story, the fallout from this story, is more important in like this window right now, that is between now and I guess when the Electoral College votes. And so, is it, you know, more of a backwards looking story, or is this really about a forwards looking story in terms of the Trump administration?
No, I think it's more forward-looking. I mean, again, if you want the backward-looking story, then if you want a relatively open and shut case, then look at Comey. And it's more difficult to disentangle Russia. But it's a forward-looking story because Trump has chosen a Secretary of State. Well, I should revise that.
Yeah.
Reportedly, because he's hedging a little bit, right, about Rex Tillerson.
It may have been a bit of a trial balloon or something.
Rex is getting a lot of pushback.
That's potentially one fight, unless he withdraws Tillerson's name, which I think might be an underrated possibility based on looking at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and looking at there are a fair number of Russia hawks, right? But, you know, sooner or later, this is going to be something that resurfaces in the 15-chapter saga of the Trump administration. And I don't know that's particularly a populist issue exactly. I think it is about you have a lot of elder statesmen, and they mostly are men because they're Republicans in the Senate, and they are the biggest check on power for Donald Trump right now, because the House is a much larger majority. The Senate, it's a narrow majority. You have the filibuster. And so if John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and Cory Gardner want to be difficult to Trump, they can stymie a lot of the Trump agenda. And so tactically, I don't know. Tactically, I don't think it's smart for Trump to be resisting the investigation and trying to nominate Tillerson at the same time. That's a lot of political capital, sometimes an overused phrase, to burn.
And that's capital with a K and a...
but these are not great fights to be picking, in part because, and you know, it's also, by the way, older Republican senators have been in the Senate for a while, but there are a lot of people in leadership to whom kind of going soft on Russia is not really a negotiable position, even though it's an extremely partisan environment nowadays. You know, you see people who are kind of openly saying, we want to have an investigation into whether the incoming Republican president, whether there was interference that helped to cause that. I mean, that's kind of a big deal.
And I would just end by saying that Russia is one of the issues on which there has generally been bipartisan agreement, at least among the American public. So the idea that this would be an issue in which Democrats and Republican senators could agree upon seems to me to fit right down the alley.
Okay. Let's wrap up there. Nate, you said it was a 15-chapter saga. That's 3.75 chapters per year of the Trump administration.
If there are four years.
Well, so, yeah. But you can choose your denominator.
I also want to say something, which is, you know, the one in X chance that what if there was not just modest interference, but what if they have compromising intelligence or something? You know, again, I don't want to sound like this. I don't think that's likely, but I think it's something one should do due diligence on.
It's the reason why we like it when people disclose business ties and information.
Yeah, and there's also a lot that we don't know.
And this has been one of those years where, you know, the looking glass definitely feels like it was behind us.
Me,
we went through that a while ago.
I guess to me, part of it is, you know, look, a lot of this is there is smoke and where is there fire, right? But if you're not investigating where there's smoke, you know, I mean, I think in terms of the big twists and turns in the Trump administration, you know, it will be based on specific actions or inactions or revelations that are kind of sensational. And I go back a little bit to Bush and Katrina, where Katrina was an event that kind of crystallized perceptions of Bush in a certain way that hadn't quite – remember, he just won re-election a year before, right, that hadn't quite been crystallized earlier. And I kind of wonder, what are those moments going to be like with the Trump administration? Do they come early? Because if he had a Katrina moment in 2021 after he just wins the second term, then I'm sure he'd be fine with that, right? But, you know, what specific pieces of intelligence, what specific mistakes does he make that become pivot points for the way that people in Congress are behaving?
Okay, let's leave it there. We have to move on. We have Amy Walter on the line, so we're going to talk about Donald Trump's call to, quote, drain the swamp and how that squares with his cabinet choices and other decisions so far. But first, a word from this week's sponsor. This week's 538 Politics podcast is brought to you by Trunk Club. Building a great wardrobe takes time, which is something that a lot of people are short on. If you're stressing about finding time to shop for clothes, relax. Trunk Club can help. Trunk Club makes it easy for you to look your best in clothes that fit you perfectly and look amazing, and they're hand-picked by your own personal stylist. Your stylist takes the time to understand your unique look and will build a perfect wardrobe with timeless classics, well-made layers, and other seasonal essentials. Go to trunkclub.com/elections, type in your measurements, share your likes and dislikes, and Trunk Club will send a trunk of clothing straight to your door. Or if you live in Dallas, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, D.C., or Charleston, you can stop by one of the Trunk Club clubhouses to work with your stylist in person for free. Trunk Club is not a subscription service. Order clothes whenever you like from your own stylist and then take 5 days to try everything on. Get started right now at trunkclub.com/elections. That's trunkclub.com/elections. One more time, trunkclub.com/elections. Okay, we're back, and we are going to talk a little bit about Donald Trump's pledge to drain the swamp, and we have a guest with us for this segment. Amy Walter is with us from D.C. She is the national editor at the Cook Political Report. Hello, Amy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to do it.
So it's worth saying that, you know, I don't think we're as interested in evaluating drain the swamp necessarily as a campaign promise, but maybe using it as a standard to try and evaluate how Trump is already changing D.C. and what it tells us about what to expect once he takes office. But first, I think we should define the swamp. Do you have a working definition of what the swamp is?
It's a place with a lot of bugs, which is a problem because I really dislike most bugs. But you know, like everything in politics, you guys, your definition of the swamp depends on what you decide the swamp actually looks like. Most of Americans would agree that Washington is a terrible place filled with terrible people. But who those terrible people are is very different depending on your political affiliation or, you know, other positions you may take on issues, et cetera. So I think in general, the feeling is, getting rid of people who are only looking out for themselves rather than looking out for the best for the country or best for quote-unquote regular Americans, right? So that's what the swamp comes to represent. But how you go about making sure that there are people in Washington that only look out for the best interests of regular people becomes a very difficult challenge, right? Because you're definition of looking out for best things for me may not be my definition of what the best thing for me is. And so I don't think you're ever going to be able to end that. Where they come from was also supposed to be part of the definition, right? You cannot be draining the swamp if, for example, you come from Washington or you come from anywhere within the power centers of America that are responsible for the terribleness of where we are in this country, whether that's Wall Street or the media or elected office.
Amy, do we think it's in the way you're in D.C., and do you think that in sort of the common parlance of D.C. of late, do you think it's taken to mean lobbyists? Has it taken to mean sort of crony congressmen on the take? I mean, is either Twitter or the beating heart of Washington, D.C.'s pounding pavement? What do you think people are mostly saying? You know, is it K Street?
Yeah, I mean, I think lobbyists get a big share of the blame or whatever, get that moniker more than anybody else. But I also think it's people who, if you're in sort of the Trump mind right now, I think it's anybody who has been part of the traditional Washington establishment. So that can be members of the traditional mainstream media. That can be folks who've been part of the foreign policy groupthink. That can be, you know, sort of fill in the blank. But in general, I think it means people who have been a part of the ecosystem of Washington for too long. And the ecosystem happens to be a swamp.
Literally and metaphorically.
Literally.
As someone from D.C., I can attest that in the summers, it is a swamp.
But what about institutional knowledge in D.C.? Are you seeing people talking about how to maintain that? Obviously, this is sort of an administration that's valuing change and people coming in from the private sector, but perhaps maybe even historical cycles past where some iteration of drain the swamp went. How are people protecting institutional knowledge?
Well, that is really the important question, right? At a time when the message from the Trump campaign throughout the campaign and then in the transition is we're going to shake things up. We're not going to do business as usual. The question is, do you keep enough people around who can, while they may not be quote-unquote traditional thinkers do understand how we got to where we got to, right? Understand the policies before they try to change them. And in that sense, I think, you know, the Trump administration has put together a pretty interesting list in its cabinet picks right now, that balance between the sort of traditional conservative voices who've been toiling away in the swamp, like Congressman Price, who's being offered up, of course, to run HHS. He's been trying to, he's been in Congress for quite some time, and he's been trying to dismantle Obamacare for as long as it's been there. Jeff Sessions has been around a long time, the senator from Alabama and attorney general pick. So they have some institutional knowledge that, of course, is different from some of the other people he's picked, including his head of Treasury, who comes with no policy background, comes from a Wall Street background. And, of course, if Rex Tillerson is picked for Secretary of State, that's somebody who comes in with no foreign policy background whatsoever. But both of those two come in with something that Trump approves of even more, which is business experience and being a leader in their field.
So on that front, in terms of the picks, which is the only kind of concrete thing we really have in terms of Trump's attempts to sort of make his mark on Washington, Harry, maybe you can jump in on this too, but like, yes, he's pulling from some congressmen and people who've been in D.C. for a long time, but he's mostly pulling from the business sector, the military sector, not career bureaucrats. Isn't that exactly what he promised? Isn't that what voters wanted?
I mean, yeah.
Exactly.
So he's maybe draining the swamp in terms of those particular – if the swamp is career bureaucrats and lobbyists who are there to get rich and have been sort of in that D.C. milieu, he's pulling from the outside.
Well, and if the goal is to dismantle a lot of the institutions, right? Let's scale back on what the EPA, at what Treasury, at what all these different departments do, oversee regulations, et cetera. But can I add one more wrinkle to this, which is guess who is going to make the most money in a new administration with all of these changes, with all of disruption, with all of these companies trying to figure out where do I stand, where do we fit in, what is this new legislation going to look like, how is it going to impact us? Lobbyists are going to make a lot of money. Yeah. Well, a lot of money.
Well, and I mean, I was just going to say, and that's usually what happens when you drain, you know, when you have new people in. These new people don't know what's exactly cooking, so they're going to listen to as many outside voices as possible. And a lot of those outside voices will, in fact, be lobbyists.
Exactly.
May I play draining the swamp devil's advocate? Mm. So we've defined swamp here as lobbyists, you know, longtime people on the take, whoever, people who have been in Washington for a long time. But Americans at large, don't people kind of group in moneymakers, people who have been sort of, you know, making dough off of hard, not to sound like a politician, hardworking Americans' backs, going back to the 2008 crisis? And I'll bring in here that Trump has appointed a lot of Goldman Sachs people.
Yes.
And I wonder if that will, if the milk will turn a little sour, perhaps. You know, I don't know. I mean, they're not of D.C., but they are certainly swamp adjacent.
I mean, Trump doesn't take half measures, right? You know, I mean, if he's going to say, I don't have to drain this, I mean, you know, you're taking a guy from Goldman Sachs, you're potentially taking the COO of ExxonMobil, which I think
those
is still
are
the largest.
DC outsiders, right? I mean, they're rich people and they operate in these circles, but they are not the 14-term congressman or senator from whatever, or the undersecretary of whatever, right? I mean, that's
Trump,
an important
Trump
distinction, no?
Trump does not tiptoe around perceptions, right? He's not tiptoe in a lily field and say, well, you know what? I did kind of say that I want to bring in business leaders in from the outside, and these are highly successful companies. But on the other hand, people tend to have a negative image of Goldman Sachs and a negative image of ExxonMobil.
Americans trust banks less, like almost as little as they trust Congress.
These are not two of the more trusted names, right? And you would think, you know, I would maybe not pick from those two companies in particular just for perception's sake, but he doesn't care. It's almost like a power
but
play.
But what would a Trump cabinet look like to you, Nate, if he was staying true to his promises of the campaign, however you want to define those? Wouldn't it look exactly like this?
No, I don't think it would.
Well, then paint me the alternate Trump cabinet that fulfills his –
maybe you pick a guy
elected
from Southwest Airlines or a company that isn't seen as having such – crony power,
like
a monopoly power.
Carl's Jr.?
Or I guess, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, there are companies that are – I mean, you know, the term is kind of economic rents, right? Do companies take advantage of a regulatory environment versus a company like Southwest Airlines. I think their flight's a little bit too bumpy, right? But this is a company that
like Papa
they got Diet Dr.
This is a company
Pepper.
That yeah, but they tried to disrupt the existing right. business
so
model.
I get what you're saying. I'm just trying to push back and tease this out a little bit. Harry and Claire jump in here, and then Amy.
I was just going to say, was collecting some data on who the first people that Reagan put into his cabinet, and in some ways, this kind of the Reagan cabinet selections look kind of a little bit like the Trump cabinet selections. Donald Reagan was a chairman and CEO of Merrill Lynch. Really didn't have that much government experience. William French Smith, who was chosen as the attorney general. I mean, he was, I believe, Ronald Reagan's personal attorney. He had served a little bit on the University of California Board of Regents. So this type of stuff, and Malcolm Baldrige was a chairman and chief executive officer of another company. This type of stuff of bringing in more business people, more from the outside, is not that unprecedented. It's not something that's come completely out of left field. This whole idea of draining the swamp, coming into Washington with a new field of players, it has happened before.
Totally agree with that. And I also like Nate's idea, too, about if you're going to bring disruptors in, some other people would argue, well, why not bring in folks in the tech sector, right, who are the next generation of leaders that are going to set the course for the quote-unquote new economy rather than going back on sort of the banks and ExxonMobil, sort of the traditional business leader types. But that goes to the heart of what Trump's campaign message has been all along, right? We're going to bring back the jobs that we once had with the people that know how to get these jobs. And so I think it's completely consistent with where he's been throughout this entire campaign, which is only smart people who know how to make money and run big, huge corporations can do that for you. And that's how you get away from it being about crony capitalism. If indeed we spend the next 3 years with really strong economic growth, then I think people sort of forget about the crony capitalism thing. If indeed we end up just in a longer period of stagnation and we are hearing more and more, not just about the folks he picks on the cabinet, but Trump's own business interests and the intersection between what we're doing in government and what kinds of deals are getting made with these companies, then yes, I think it can be a much longer term bigger problem. And clearly, this is a more polarized place, and the media is very much ready to write these stories.
Amy, we talk a lot about who Reagan's appointees were, but I'm actually wondering about Carter and how Carter sort of approached his transition in first few years in office, because he was very much the man from Plains, very much the Washington outsider. That was his whole thing. I mean, and obviously Republicans are more apt to appoint people from business. But I'm wondering if we can draw any sort of lessons or comparisons from the way that Carter sort of came into Washington from the outside.
It's funny that you portrayed it like that, Claire, because one of the very first people I talked to after the election ended, who's an old sort of grizzled Republican who's been around Washington for a long time, mm-hmm. said, look, Trump's either going to be Reagan or Carter, and I have no idea which one. But they both, it's exactly right. Well, that we don't know which one yet, but those are two.
For our 10-year-old listeners, you don't want to be Jimmy Carter if you're president.
For our 10-year-old.
You want to be Jimmy Carter as an ex-president.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
I think there are parallels to Calvin Coolidge. I mean, I don't know. I think the range of possibilities is broad.
Harry, a quick...
Now you're going really far back.
A quick thought on this, and I want to get one more question for Amy, and then we're going to move on.
No, I was just going to say, I think, as Nate was saying and as Claire was pointing out, look, the idea of coming in and... as I said, draining the swamp, outsider, there's nothing necessarily new about that. There are different ways that you can do it, but your ability to drain the swamp is only, I guess, as Amy was kind of hinting at, is only as good as your next day's economy is, right? The idea being that they're going to, if the economy starts going boom, they're not going to care about crony capitalism. The reason they care about crony capitalism right now is because people feel as if the economy has been stuck and they haven't been able to get ahead. People are upset not because of crony capitalism. They assign the cause to crony capitalism. They're upset because the economy is going nowhere. And once, if the economy starts going somewhere, they'll be able to say, whatever we're doing, it's working. We're just going to go with that.
And that's a nice reminder that really the way to evaluate a lot of these picks, as we did last week and we'll continue to do, is about, when it comes to policies and then when the administration is in power, what the actual real world effect of this administration is, and that's where the real conversation needs to land. Amy, really quickly on another element of DC and culture shift and all this stuff we've been discussing, can you just describe like what this transition period between the election and inauguration is like normally, if there's such a thing in DC? I know that there's like civil servants who are scrambling for new jobs, polishing up their resume, considering going to the private sector, other people trying to get in. Are things different right now on that front in terms of the kind of like that lower level of the swamp, if you want to call it that?
I think things are similar in that vein. The question is how serious this lobbying ban will be and whether or not younger folks, especially those in their 30s, are going to sign up to work in an administration where they may be banned either for life from lobbying a foreign government or for 5 years, which if you get out of government service at 40 or in your prime earning years, to be banned from going into the private sector lobbying would be a big consideration. Although there are plenty of other people who say, look, these are not laws that these are not hard to get around, and that a good employment lawyer can get you out of them. But I think that is certainly something, at least when I was talking to the sort of younger lobbying folks, that was hanging over their heads.
And it's worth pointing out that the Obama administration, when they came in, tried to do some similar stuff too in terms of drawing lines and saying we're not going to have, you know, lobbyists in our, at least in the executive branch, and they had to issue a number of waivers because, like, if you start to just cross off large categories of people, you know, no bureaucrats, no lobbyists, then all of a sudden there's no one left in D.C.
other than the persecution of the lobbyists.
Right. And then in terms of just like people who, you know, aren't political appointees but are just mid-level staffers at the EPA or DHS or whatever, like are they – do you get a sense of whether
are they
sticking around or are they fleeing because this is such a big unknown? What's your sense there?
Depends on sort of where you are in your category and in your category of life, right, in terms of – you know, a lot of folks take these jobs in part because they're secure and stable if you're in a non-political position. But if you are worried that the position that you've been working in is going to be either overly politicized, you're going to do things that you don't necessarily agree with, then you have to make that decision for yourself. But for the pure political people, we're still dealing with pretty much the same stuff you deal with every 4 years, which is if you get into this business, like if you get into sports, there is a good chance you're going to be traded or get injured, or it's not the most stable of career choices.
Unlike journalism.
And so you put up with this. Unlike journalism, totally stable. Totally.
Okay. Well, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, thank you so much for doing this, and we hope we'll talk to you sometime soon. But thanks again for joining
us. Thanks, guys. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time to wrap up. But before we do that, if you'll just indulge me really quick in a word of logistics. Hopefully this isn't too insidery for listeners. But I just wanted to say that and announce that Galen Druk, who a number of our listeners probably know, is the producer of the show but has also been on the show several times and has reported our Ross Perot documentary. We're very excited that Galen is like officially on board with this podcast and part of our podcast family, and more importantly, he's going to be doing some reporting for us, working on more documentaries, more. So you'll be hearing more from Galen Druk as this year goes on, which is very exciting.
He's the bee's knees.
He is the bee's knees. And slightly related to Galen coming on board is that I, just for what it's worth, I'm not going anywhere. I'm still hosting this podcast, but I'm taking on this new project with 30 for 30 podcasts, sports documentaries that are making me very excited. So I'm stepping back a little bit from the 538 world. My other podcast, What's the Point, ended last week. Shed a tear. But I say all this by way of saying that we've got some big, interesting, new, ambitious plans for podcasting in our little corner of the podcast universe in 2017. So stick around. I think we're going to do some really interesting stuff, and I am excited for everyone to hear it. Okay, Nate Silver, thank
congratulations,
you.
Galen and Jody. Hey, have you ever noticed, by the way, that people only use the word thrilled when they're making a hiring announcement, or I'm thrilled to announce that TKTK?
I use it sarcastically.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm thrilled.
I was not using it sarcastically.
Couldn't be more thrilled.
I don't know if I use it. I think I use it.
You use that when you're writing it. I couldn't be more thrilled to join blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, it's if a you're nice a teenager, word. You say, that was thrilling.
This podcast has been thrilling.
That's exactly right. Okay, Nate Silver, thank you. And thank you for just, like, your just overwhelming show of thrillness.
I'm thrilled.
Let's make thrill happen this year, but in an unironic way.
Claire Malone, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was so thrill.
Stop trying to make thrill happen.
I like it.
Harry Enten, it's been fun.
Exuberance.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Micah Cohen is 538's politics editor. Jorge Estrada and Ryan Nantel are in the control room. We will be back next Monday. In the meantime, you can be in touch by emailing us podcasts@538.com. You can also tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. You can find our show in iTunes, Google Play, or the new ESPN app, which is very slick and easy to use, or wherever you get your podcasts. We will be there. Shout out to iTunes for naming us one of the best podcasts of 2016. Thank you very much. Your check's in the mail. Our website is 530. It's not.
It's not.
Folks, it's not. Actually, no, sorry. Just to be clear. Our website is 538.com/podcasts. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in iTunes. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings. When our rankings go up, others discover the show. Or you can just tell someone about the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.